This episode of the CE Drive podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the life insurance licensing program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. This episode will be good for continuing education credits in all jurisdictions. No IROC credits yet, but we will have financial planning credits for this episode. And also for those in Alberta, this episode will not be good for accident and sickness credits. Be good for life credits, but not accident and sickness credits. Hi, and welcome back to the CE Drive podcast. This is Jason Watt. We'll be spending the next little more than an hour or so together listening to three interviews from three different financial advisors. I am curious for feedback on this. If you'd pop over to iTunes and leave us a review, this episode will have a lot less of me and a lot more of advisors. And I'm interested to hear what model people like, if people like more of the interviews and less stuff from Jason, or where that balance lies. So we don't have a lot of reviews on iTunes yet. Anything over there would be appreciated. Anyways, we're going to spend the hour plus talking about retirement concepts, and those retirement concepts touch on a broad range of stuff. We don't get into product very much. It really is all planning stuff. So I really enjoyed the three conversations here. The color for today's episode is green. The color for today's episode is green. Our first interview is going to be with Chris, and Chris is going to talk about a bunch of maybe somewhat nerdy stuff. Chris is, you'll hear this, as much of a financial planning nerd as I am, and he mentions a concept called fat tail risk. Other than that, I think most of what he talks about I'll be able to cover in the show notes, but I just want to explain what fat tail risk is. So normally, when you have a bell curve, there's a distribution of data where you have a whole bunch of likely events sort of in the middle and then unlikely events out on the fringes. But in a fat tail risk event, which is how Chris describes the likelihood of needing long-term care later in retirement, that fat tail event is that need for long-term care. And the suggestion there is that it's an event that we would expect to be unlikely, but in fact, the likelihood of it happening is greater than would properly show up in a proper statistical distribution. Other than that, check the show notes for some stuff related to what Chris has for us, and enjoy what Chris has to say. Thanks very much for joining us today, Chris. Something that you and I have talked about a lot over the years, and I know something you have a deep personal interest in, probably burned a lot of time in Excel dealing with these problems, is retirement withdrawal rates, or withdrawal rates in retirement. And I'm hoping you can just take a few minutes to talk about why you find this such an interesting topic.
For sure. It really is the million-dollar question, or depending on your assumptions, the $2 to $4 million or greater question. And from, I guess, an interest perspective, it is that of being quantitative in nature in terms of kind of the mathematical modeling behind how much do you need to retire and what is an appropriate amount you can take out of your portfolio on an annual basis, juggling all kinds of highly dynamic and highly unpredictable factors such as mortality, mortality of your spouse, sequence of returns of the investment portfolio, sequence of inflation or arguably deflation, economic factors, tax impacts, and then you layer on all the non-tangibles such as behavioral biases, loss aversion, cognitive function, and possibly a spouse passing away. There's just so many different factors to how much do I need to retire and can I start pulling out yet? And how much can I pull out safely? I am on the younger end as far as of advisors go. I'm in my mid-30s, and I believe the average age now is 59 or so, I have heard. So bear in mind, I'm probably actually not the most appropriate person to speak to this topic, as nothing beats real-life street experience versus just reading papers and what have you. But yes, it is a fascinating topic to me. I only have a few clients who are in this scenario, truly withdrawing from their portfolio and lacking specifically a defined benefit pension plan. Of course, modeling and retirement planning is tremendously easy if husband and wife are both civil sector people, or in the case of Alberta, some of the few being Enbridge and Suncor, where you can still get a DB pension despite being private sector employers. And the job is really easy. You say, okay, teacher and nurse, or city bus driver and whatever, here are your two DB pensions. Let's play with the calculators. Very commonly here in Alberta, LAPP, I always quite like. Many people are on LAPP. What I really like is their calculator is open to the public, so to speak. So depending who is listening right now and what province you're in, the equivalent of LAPP, which many nurses and therapists are on, for example, and many professors and different academics are on, you can Google the calculator. In contrast, for example, Alberta Teachers Retirement Fund, ATRF, being the body and pension administrator for all the tens of thousands of teachers in Alberta, it is not public. So it's kind of frustrating. I'm sitting with a nurse practitioner and, you know, she's on LAPP, he's on ATRF, Alberta Teachers Retirement Fund. And then, you know, for her, I could just play with the calculator right there on my computer in front of them. And I could loosely say, okay, you had 1 year of mat leave. Do you think you'll buy back in? You're this old, average 5 year best average, blah, blah, blah. We put in the inputs. Okay, great. You know, crudely speaking, $3,300 a month pre-tax for life. Awesome. Okay, now go to the teacher. Okay, well, unfortunately, please track down your password and your login. I'm sure you don't have it, so bug HR. They'll put you in touch with so-and-so, da-da-da-da-da. So sure enough, a month later, we're back together, and he had all the detail. Very motivated clients, so we had a really good report organized. And I just said, hey, let's pretend, you know, 55, 60, and 65. And those numbers are not unrealistic for them based on their incomes and their lifestyle choices and their propensity to pay off debt and invest. They could retire at 55 despite the reduced pension benefits. So winded way of saying, Jason, what's so fascinating about it? When there's DB pensions, which is quite common in Edmonton, being a civilly based city with many provincially employed people, my job is easy, so to speak. It's old age security, Canada pension plan, and then what does your DB pension plan do at work for you? Makes it pretty easy. All we have to do is choose when you want to retire, and of course, how are your debt levels? Are you mortgage free, et cetera? And have you done the big ticket items like the fridge, the new vehicle, and the deep freeze, and a flat screen TV, which people often forget about because that can easily be, you know, 50 to 100 grand of after-tax capital. Then we go to clients who don't have DB pensions. And that's where I find this truly fascinating is, I want to say it was Bogle, help me out, Jason, if I'm correct, in the mid-90s-ish, came up with the famous 4% rule. Was it Bogle? Maybe I'm wrong. But the famous 4% rule, perhaps many people have heard of, that you can withdraw 4% per year of your portfolio. I want to say at age 65 was his assumption. And there's an extremely high probability that you will not run out of capital, and that 4% you withdraw every year actually tracks inflation. So the next year goes up with consumer price index, 2% or 3% or what have you. And that he assumed a lot of things in his modeling. Dr. Fau, I believe is how you pronounce it, P-F-A-U, has a lot of stuff online, a lot of fascinating academic papers. I believe he's with Princeton. He's truly carved out a niche of academia in this area of finance. I believe he has a PhD in economics as well as his CFA charter. And we actually had him speak here in Edmonton for a CFA function, and very tremendously fascinating man. And I, at the end of the meeting, kind of said, okay, so you've criticized the 4% rule from the 90s. Of course, since then, people are living much longer. And of course, interest rates, all things equal, are now assumed to be much lower for the foreseeable, arguably, decades. And I said, what's the Twitter version? Would you say if it's on a 4% rule, what is it now? And he said, more like a 3% rule was kind of his extremely condensed commentary, that if a client had $1 million, and this sounds kind of depressing, how many clients, if they're middle income, ignoring defined benefit pension plans and the commuted value associated there, just straight up, they're private sector, no DB pensions, how many middle income people, which is the majority of, on average, advisors' clients, have $1 million liquid? Right? And ask yourself that, you know, unless you're one of the elite who just has high net worth clients all over the place, no big deal. You know, $1 million is a good chunk of change. And even on $1 million, let's say they have their house, another conversation as well, another reason I find it fascinating. Well, let's say their house, they want to live there, they have good health, they can see themselves being in the house for the next 20 years. $1 million, 3%, 30 grand a year. and then that tracks inflation. Not that crazy good of a lifestyle. It's not tremendous. Now, granted, if they've paid into CPP over the years, they'll get some of that. But again, if somebody took a good chunk of their career off, it might only be a couple hundred bucks a month. My parents, for example, mom was 200 and change a month, and dad was the full $1,000 a month. So it's not always, you know, the Canadian average, I believe, is $600 or $650 per month for CPP. OAS, of course, is $570 plus minus, or $590 now, I guess. Those are spectacular because they give you the guaranteed income stream, which makes them the planning perspective much more attractive. And the other big thing that is fascinating with respect to this is the annuity puzzle. Is a behavioral economist, I've coined the term the annuity puzzle, that a lot of people, and perhaps as advisors, you see this with your clients, is the aversion to buying a life annuity. From a pure capital allocation perspective, a life annuity is tremendously efficient. And this is what Dr. Fowle's research has also reinforced, is a good chunk of the asset mix should be into a guaranteed lifetime life annuity, and the balance should be in liquid assets, specifically equities. But clients are very averse. And my oldest client, who is sharp as a tack, and she literally drives from the Okanagan, British Columbia, to Edmonton to visit family on her own, which is like a 10-hour drive almost. She is in her mid or late 80s now. I wanted to offer her a life annuity, and she was actually averse to it. It was so funny. You could see that behavioral economics face to face, that she just didn't like the concept of the illiquid nature, giving all the insurance, all the capital with the insurance company. There is such a hyper affinity to liquidity as someone ages, even if the life annuity made a tremendous amount of sense. And at the time that we were sitting, I believe I could still offer her a guaranteed amount. She had no kids, but she had a lot of nieces and nephews she was very close with, that even the commuted value, if you want to call that, or the present value of the future cash flows, could still pay out if she got hit by a bus the next day. She understood it. She was very sharp, but just straight up. In the end, we actually went with what is arguably a less optimal solution, which is some of the seg funds that have life annuity features tied to a seg fund pool. Of course, the fees are much higher, and all things equal, your IRR to death on cash flows will be impaired versus the life annuity version. The other consideration, just speaking as a practitioner, is unfortunately life annuities are very lean. It's like selling GICs. You have mortality data, you have interest rate assumptions, and that's it. It's like mortgage rates, five-year mortgage rates, fiercely competitive. So the advisors does not make very much. That's just as a practitioner, that also creates an internal bias. And even Dr. Fowle talks about that. That's maybe another reason that you don't see life annuities that often, is from an advisor perspective, would you rather manage the client's portfolio or do a life annuity? So just making a side comment that that could be another factor at play of why they're not that popular. Layering in the house is always quite fascinating, I find, as well. Because if they're middle income-ish and they have that $1 or $2 million nest egg, retirement's looking decent, layer in the government benefits, and they're looking pretty good. But things like health crisis, a need for liquidity where they don't want to touch the portfolio, again, kind of an endowment bias there. They'd much rather hold on to that than give it up, especially if they know it's going to mess with their future income streams. It's nice to have the house as a backup plan. And again, I know there's academic literature. I think, Jason, you've even sent me some articles on this, where you're using your house as a part of the retirement strategy. So that if you did have to create liquidity and downsize, and I have multiple clients that are in this scenario, they've got the beautiful home where they raised the family, or they've got the acreage, or they've got the farm, they're 57 or 62 in my office, they've got good health, at least in the back pocket, they know they could sell that piece of property. Hopefully it's mortgage-free if they've been intelligent over their working life. They could always sell it. And I actually have a client just like this, sell the acreage for $1 million. Very likely where he would live would be a facility, not a facility, but a elders only or 50 plus type of townhouse complex, more in the city versus where the acreage is. And in today's dollars, so you could argue in inflation adjusted terms, you know, sell the acreage at $1 million in real terms and buy something for $500,000. So that would create $500,000 of liquidity and he'd still be mortgage free. So it's nice to have that in the back pocket as well, if clients are in that position. So a lot of different moving pieces, and it's all unpredictable is the unfortunate part. But in the words of, although he did not originally coin the term, but it's often granted to Warren Buffett, but you'd rather be approximately correct than precisely wrong.
So something you said there, and that's a lot to think about, Chris, a lot to deal with. Something you said there specifically leads me to a question, and that is, so you obviously are a fan of annuities. You like the role they fill. You've given this some thought. If you were going to make annuities more attractive for clients, if there was something that you could get the product providers to do to help you get your clients to make the annuity decision, any thoughts given to that?
Great question. And actually, I'd say the industry actually has done a decent job there. Sun Life, Manulife, Empire Life still have products out there in the seg space world where they are tied to your age and obviously assumed mortality. And they are basically a life annuity with liquidity. Of course, they have these obscenely convoluted formulas surrounding redeeming more than you're allowed to and the future impact that has on future income streams. But at least the client knows they have liquidity. So you can kind of get the best of both worlds. Overall, your IRR and cash flows will be impaired, but sometimes clients just don't care about that. They just want to know they have the liquidity and they've got guarantees. They might pay for those features, but people aren't always rational. So they sometimes just want the features of liquidity and guaranteed income stream going forward. And to answer your question, I'm actually happy with what the industry has offered. Again, case in point, the woman who was in her early 80s at the time chose to go with a Manulife product, which was effectively just all fixed income with annuity-like features. And it's paying her every month. She's very happy with the monthly income, and she's got liquidity if she needs it. And the leftover, quote-unquote, of the funds would go to her nieces and nephews when she passes.
Then my next question here, Chris, concerns spending rates. So it's a related question to withdrawal rates. And what are your thoughts on, you know, you hear all kinds of different rules around spending rates. Do people need, you know, 50% of their income, 60% of their income, 70% of their income? And you mentioned CPP and OAS earlier. When you bring all of that into account, what are your thoughts around the needed level of income to sustain a retirement?
So again, like so many things in financial planning, it's going to be a classic. It depends, or it's case specific. Of course, we could just use the stat that commonly I think gets thrown around, which is 70% of working years income, which should be used in retirement. But again, it's so dynamic, right? You know, more and more kind of Gen X or even older millennials are not having kids. That's kind of my age bracket. So if they're not having kids, the lifestyle they've become accustomed to, the big change when they go from working years to retirement was hopefully all their debts are paid off. No more car payments, no more mortgage payment, you know, versus all things equal, family of four, maybe a spouse was working, was not working on and off with respect to their career. And then the kids are all out of their house. So now their income needs have gone down and the mortgage free. Well, and you know, example A versus example B, can you still use that 70% guideline? Probably not, right? And that's a function of having reared children, only to be more complex in the case of a disabled child if there's ongoing longer term needs surrounding planning. So it's really hard to use these simple heuristics, benchmarks with respect to clients. It's so case specific. Dr. Pfau actually, in his presentation, I quite like this term, so somebody else can steal it from me and I stole it from him. But you know, there's the go-go years in retirement, there's the slow-go years, and there's the no-go years. So a lot, you know, you're traveling, you're jet setting, you're buying grandkids gifts, you're going to Hawaii, then you slow her down a little bit in your 70s and you're just, you know, having coffee at Tim's for 4 hours a day. And then the no-go years are kind of the last chapter of life, sadly, and hopefully you still have cognitive function and decent health, but you sure aren't jet setting, and even getting a coffee out of town or out in the town is a drag. So of course, spending rates will be dynamic with respect to that. The big fat tail risk, or questionably probable severe event, is of course health. And granted, we are pretty lucky to be in a universal system in Canada, not to get into healthcare and political opinions, but of course that is always a risk. A lot of the literature is American driven, so they often talk about if you got sick, do you have to dip into your portfolio? Do you have critical illness? Do you have to sell your house, et cetera? That said, it's still in Canada though, even though things are subsidized, you know, it can still be easily $1,500 to $2,000 and easily well above. I have one set of clients quite affluent. I think grandma's at a facility which is $7,000 a month here in Canada. So those numbers do exist out there. You know, if she has 10 years ahead of her, that is whatever, $840,000. That's a lot of money, right? On an after-tax basis. Maybe there's a tax credit. I don't know. So a lot of things to think about is, I guess, the short answer. The other thing I also observe, and I've seen this firsthand as well, is a hyper risk aversion to spending, because now they're really into that mindset of, okay, this is my nest egg. This has to last my entire life. So you see a couple of things is they really are very cautious to spend money. They're also very cautious with respect to their portfolio. And they often will underestimate the power of inflation just because it's so easy to think, hey, I want GICs and fixed income and maybe a life annuity. Well, all those things, the implied returns in the case of a life annuity, all those things will probably have a challenge keeping pace with inflation. While inflation, the silent killer, inflation over a 25-year time horizon, you know, at 2% compounding, will erode a dollar probably by 65, 70% on a compounding basis. That's also, you know, important to hold. inflation-adjusted asset classes, whether it's equities or real estate or things that track inflation. TIPS are very common in the U.S., basically treasuries that track inflation. No different than if you're sitting with a 25 or 35-year-old, you'd say, oh, you've got a 25 or 35-year time horizon. Why aren't we saying that to a retired person? In theory, a portion of their portfolio will have a 20 or 30-year time horizon. In fact, Dr. Pfau makes a very interesting contrarian comment surrounding asset allocation is very commonly, and we've all heard this heuristic as well, you know, your age should be the approximate percentage of your portfolio, which is in safe assets. So you're 30 years old, 70% equities, 30% fixed income, just to, again, really simplify matters. As you age and approach retirement, you know, you're 60 years old, well, now you have 40% equities, 60% fixed income. And that's important as you approach retirement. You really want to have conservative assets to avoid the 2008 or 2001 or whatever crisis event might decimate your portfolio by 30% 6 months before retirement. That can be very stressful. But then his big point is you should actually have equities their lowest right after you retire, shortly after you retire, so that if there is an economic correction of a significant magnitude shortly after you retire, it's so hard to recover from a 30% haircut 2 years into retirement. As you're withdrawing from the portfolio, how do you recover from a big correction? It's so tough. So his argument is actually, because markets are unpredictable, actually have a conservative portfolio as you approach retirement, conservative portfolio coming out of retirement, but as you age, you're actually increasing the allocation to risky asset classes, which then furthermore, he dovetails off that concept and says, if you do have a portion of your asset mix in life annuities, as you age, you're effectively eroding mortality credits, if you want to think about it that way. So that almost automatically creates that asset allocation shift, that even if you weren't rebalancing explicitly, just by aging, you're eroding the leftover of the life annuity, which reduces the allocation to safe stuff, aka life annuity, and all things equal, increases the allocation to risky assets. And then from a straight up cash is king perspective, again, back to Pfau's concepts, is access to liquidity. That if you need access to capital, you've got those liquid assets available. So I probably haven't really answered your question, but those are a number of thoughts which I hope somewhat help.
No, that's really good, Chris. I didn't think you were going to come to one answer to the question. In fact, if I'd heard one answer to the question, I think it would have been maybe a failure of planning, right? If it's the same answer for everybody.
Yeah. So I guess the Twitter version is the client cases that I've seen. And again, you know, ask me in 30 years and I'll have way more data sets to speak to. But the clients thus far, which is unfortunately only a handful at this point in my career, who are quote unquote spending money, is they're all mortgage free. They have all between $1 and $3 million of liquid assets. And they seem all quite content to live on about $5,000 a month. And that covers their travel, their property taxes, utilities, Netflix, you know, helping out the kids here and there, you know, and that's just my cases, you know, so you could say, quote unquote, they're high net worth, you know, net worth of $2 to $4 million plus minus, but they got there through just good old fashioned savings, living below their means, paying off debt. They enjoyed real estate appreciation, certainly over the last 30 years. Everyone's different. What I do find though is people who often have this kind of behavior set end up leaving a decent net worth behind to their kids or grandkids because they're just wired that way. They almost can't spend enough because they got there because they were frugal or lived below their means and weren't materialistic. Then you meet the clients who are 30 or 40, highly materialistic, great cash flows. You know, he's a prince, she's a princess, whatever the case might be. And they're probably going to have money problems their whole life. And in retirement, whatever nest egg they have, they might end up squandering it and they'll have to make, unfortunately, consumption pattern choice changes in lifestyle as they age. And that's really tough once you kind of get used to something. It's easy to go one direction, but not the other lifestyle wise. So yeah, a lot of moving pieces, but I think I need a few more decades to really speak to what I see clients doing. But if I really had to just crudely use a benchmark, I don't think 70% is a really bad number, because for many people, the mortgage is done and kids are hopefully out of the house. Try to get some crude numbers on what they were spending before and what they're spending after when you give that guidance. Of course, it's dynamic. Even with retired clients, you should still be, of course, meeting them every 6 to 12 months, what have you, with respect to rebalancing. If you are using a spending rate, an interesting approach, and I almost wish more defined benefit pension plans did this in Canada. It was actually looked at with Bill, don't quote me, I can't remember the number, but it was looked at for LAPP specifically a few years ago, and it did not go through very sadly. But the premise was the inflation improvements on the defined benefit payouts for retirees would be subject to a board approval, depending on economic factors, every year. So, you know, you got $3,000 last year, there's not a guaranteed 2% bump based on CPI, consumer price index, this year. If the markets had a massive correction, or actuarial data came out, people are living way longer, or new entrants into the pool was not as strong as they had hoped for younger people coming into the defined benefit pension pool, they could revisit inflation on an annual basis. And when you run those models, not that you need to be an actuary, but the sensitivity analysis surrounding a light change in inflation assumptions for only a couple of years can make things so much more sustainable. Case in point, not to get on a political rant about Trudeau, but old age security, you know, the chief actuary of Canada and his team, or her team, I'm not sure, the people behind, did all this research, huge amounts of sustainability increase to push it out to 67. They did it brilliantly with like a, 20 or 30 year sliding scale, I can't remember. So no one's, you know, riding in the streets because overnight they're getting the short end of the stick. If you're about to flip to 65, for example, it was a sliding scale. You know, so it's very gradual month by month over a whatever 10 or 20 year period. And then all of a sudden, you know, arguably to get votes, they reverse all that work. But if you were to run the numbers and ask an actuary's opinions, that made it so much more sustainable. So those sustainability ratios with respect to pension accounting, again, which is certainly out of scope for a talk of this nature, go up so dramatically with little mini changes when you run the numbers. The other thing I do want to speak to, Jason, which I just thought of, was, and I read this in an article, not Pfau's work, but some other literature surrounding retirement modeling, especially for people who lack defined benefit pension plans, is kind of the mental accounting surrounding the income streams. So as a Canadian, maybe you say your old age security in your Canada pension plan is kind of your cat food fund. That's how I tell clients it. I say, hey, you know, you worked most of your career and you worked your entire career. You'll get about this much in CPP. OAS, you'll get about this much. That's kind of your cat food fund. That covers at least your utilities. You'll be mortgage free, food, at least you're not on the street. And on a side note, I always like to make clients aware, CPP overall is well funded. Forum Magazine, for those of you who are Advocus members, had a really good article by the president of Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, where he talks about the solvency ratios and the funded status ratios and the entrance of new people into CPP versus retirees. And it's very, very well funded. And it's a separate pot of capital. It is a truly separate pot of capital. Old age security, unfortunately, is from general revenue. So from a tax policy perspective, that is a risk. If the government has major federal deficits, old age security does come from general revenue. So if somebody had to take a haircut, it would be OAS before CPP. So I always like to have that conversation with clients. On a side note, again, I think I'm correct with the following. At least we're not the US. I believe literally the US buys their own T-bills, which is their own debt, and they consider it an asset on the balance sheet side, which is just insane to me, as you're just moving money from one pocket to the other and saying, hey, we're well-funded for government benefits on the pension side. But that's another conversation as well. So then cat food fund is your government benefits. And then you want to get a Corvette eventually, you want to help the grandkids, you want to go traveling, what have you. Maybe that's your medium risk portfolio. Stocks, bonds, rental property, whatever, paper assets of real estate, REITs. Maybe you layer in the life annuity, although I'd argue the life annuity would be kind of part of that guaranteed base. But then kind of the second tier is, okay, the lifestyle things, aka traveling. And then the third layer is kind of things like philanthropy, helping out the grandkids to a larger degree. That's certainly where life insurance can come in from an estate perspective, or other liquid assets if you want to spend while you're alive, which is an interesting topic to have as well. Do you want to spend the money while you're alive, arguably probably with less tax efficiency versus life insurance, or do you want to leave it behind through a will and estate planning? But kind of the mental accounting behind those different layers of income stream and how the client perceives those with respect to spending.
Okay, yeah, that's a lot of good stuff, Chris. A lot of research goes into that stuff, and I agree with you. I read Wade Pfau's stuff as well and find it quite interesting. I'll actually link to some of that stuff when I put out the actual podcast. Actually, you talked about best efforts indexing for LEPP as a failed proposal. I know one pension that does have that is HOOP in Ontario, the Healthcare Employees of Ontario Pension Plan. Has a best efforts indexing. So they review exactly what you're suggesting, review every year to see if it's suitable to index the pension.
That's interesting. And that's why I was like chatting with you, Jason. You have this nation border to border knowledge base. So yeah, that's great. I think it's such a smart thing. I wish more pension bodies entertained that. And on a side note, if anyone's listening still, is if you kind of enjoy the premise of pension modeling, and I don't mean, you know, seeking to become a member of the Canadian Institute of Actuaries, but a really good book that's just well done and not hardcore technical, but quite fascinating, is The Third Rail. So The Third Rail is the title. It was written by, I believe, a financial journalist, but the main author that would capture attention was the past president of Ontario Teachers Pension, I think. And he kind of goes over the challenges of pensions in today's modern economy. And he talks about three jurisdictions. New Brunswick, interestingly, because it was very tiny, very fragmented, very small population base. Talks about Holland, I believe, as they had very much a culture, kind of like the Japanese, around being conservative and hyper savings. Although the Japanese, of course, they had the problems surrounding debt. But I believe they like to hover around a 130% funded status. So their defined pension obligations are basically the present value of income obligations relative to assets in the pool of 130%, which is tremendous. You know, people in Canada are happy if their pension is, you know, 80 or 90% funded status. And the third jurisdiction was, you would think Detroit, but I think it was actually Maine. Maine, USA, although it didn't make media like Detroit or California, had insane issues to the point where two testimonials I recall from the book, which, and again, this book, I can't stress it enough. It's really good. It's a fairly quick light read, The Third Rail. A fireman who was a chief fireman, just whatever was negotiated for firemen of that jurisdiction, you know, quote unquote, he retired around 55, a fairly early retirement. And he was in his 70s or maybe early 80s, but, you know, plus minus whatever, 20 years. His income had literally doubled over that time frame, which is, again, mind-boggling, and I mean retirement income. And another one was the bank account from which one of the pension administrators was actually cutting the checks and mailing out checks or wiring money. That bank account actually ran out of cash. So, like, how do you get to that level, right? But again, the third rail, I learned this only as well from the book, was, you know, it's the metaphor that you don't want to touch environmental rights or gay rights or religion or what have you if you're a politician, and you sure don't want to touch people's pensions. And it's very contentious. It's very complex. The older people say, don't change what I had for the last 30 years. The new people say, hey, make sure this is sustainable for me. So how do you touch it as a politician? So yeah, really good book. And even if you have DB pensions, try to hedge your bets with other asset classes.
That's awesome, Chris. Thanks very much for joining us today and sharing so much of the work you've done around retirement planning. I'm sure that your clients benefit for the depth of technical knowledge there, although I see you do keep it distinct, right? You talk to a client and you don't necessarily want to dig into Wade Fowle's research or whatever the case is, right?
My favorite clients are the ones where I can, Jason.
Nice. That's probably a rare breed. Yeah, let's look forward to some future conversations, Chris. I know there's lots there. And we'll hitch up again for maybe some thoughts around retirement planning in 20 years when you have that giant sample size you're looking for.
Okay, that was Chris talking about some of his thoughts around retirement planning, and you hear that sort of a mix of kind of real life and the deeply theoretical. I find that interesting. Our next interview is going to be with Craig. And Craig's interview here, I think, is a little bit more what we would expect in a typical financial planning discussion. Craig doesn't get so much into the theoretical weeds, as it were. I did want to just give Craig kudos for one thing here. I kind of disparaged the community of St. Albert with one of my questions here. Craig is a big community guy. He really loves his community, and you see this. He does a ton of volunteer work, highly respected in the community. And Craig comes right to St. Albert's defense. So I thought that was pretty awesome, actually. I really appreciated that, and I learned something from Craig's answer, which is good. And there's a whole bunch I could talk about with Craig's volunteer work, but it's to be respected, and he really does walk the walk there. You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College, bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up. And you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way.
This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Thanks very much for joining us today, Craig.
Oh, my pleasure.
Craig is a financial planner based in St. Albert. Craig carries both his insurance license and his funds license, primarily operates a financial planning practice.
Yep.
And in the course of that financial planning practice, I know, Craig, you run into, I think, what is a common concern in this business, and that is people who are starting their retirement plan and they might feel like they're too late for there to be any meaningful impact. Can you talk a little bit about clients you run into that are starting a little bit later in life than we might like?
Yeah, it's not an uncommon circumstance. The other part of that circumstance is there's often kind of a feeling of tension, I guess, in the relationship, if it's a married couple or something to that effect, because of where they are. I know I've had some conversations where people are in their early 50s and they're looking at where they are in their accumulation and looking at where they are in retirement or towards retirement. And, you know, they're looking for help. They're looking for clarity. And they want to kind of have a little bit more of a sense of the direction they're taking.
Now, you talk about some strife or maybe some discord in the relationship. Do you find that there's often the scenario where one person feels like they've done the right things and the other person is sort of a drag on the retirement planning?
No, I think it's just the differences in terms of different opinions on money. You know, should money be spent, enjoy the day, or should we be stowing our nuts away and waiting for winter type of, clash, I guess, in terms of opinion. And that's, like I said, that's not uncommon. So it's just about finding compromise. And a lot of the time it comes down to really setting up something on a monthly schedule, some sort of disciplined approach that allows them to do both, so that you're figuring out what is the objective. You know, was it a vacation that, you know, allows you to have that, enjoy the day. But at the meantime, putting those, storing nuts for winter so that you can enjoy your retirement as well. And a lot of the time it just comes down to setting up some sort of disciplined approach on a monthly basis or bi-monthly so that you're doing it without thinking, right? Setting up these monthly contribution plans and allocating it to, you know, different types of accounts, whether it's your RSP or your TFSA or something to that effect, or a vacation fund for that matter.
Have you had it with clients where you did set up pre-authorized contributions as you're describing, and it sounds like maybe a budget to go along with that, and the clients haven't had success with that? The clients have had to abandon or have felt like they had to abandon those commitments?
I haven't specifically had a situation where they've had to contact me and say, Craig, we need to cancel this or something to that effect. Part of those provisions is to try to have everybody on board by saying, this is the plan and this is where it'll get us. You know, this is your current state. This is your desired state. This is what's going to help us get there. Now, you can't control what happens, you know, an emergency, your furnace or your air conditioner or whatever it is, something relevant requires a lump sum of money, but that's part of the plan as well, is trying to plan for those types of unforeseen circumstances. You know, disability, critical illness, these types of things can disrupt any plan if not kind of taken into account in the initial planning process. So that's where we look at, you know, in terms of the full financial picture. It's not just, you know, how much are we saving, but it's what other measures are we taking to kind of mitigate risk and through the use of insurance and whatnot to help offset some of those unforeseen circumstances that can come down the road.
You mentioned getting the client to exhibit good behaviors by showing them where they can end up if they do these things well. Do you have some particular tool or way of demonstrating that to the client, something that they use to visualize or somehow make something concrete out of what otherwise can be a difficult concept?
Yeah, there's, we have financial planning software that can allow you to augment certain variables to help provide a little bit more clarity as to, you know, what rate of return do we need in order to achieve our retirement goal, or what contribution amount, you know, how does that need to be augmented? You know, do we need to put in more? If we have this rate of return, can we pull back? Or, you know, our intended retirement is 65 or 60, and we can adjust the date of their, you know, anticipated retirement to see, okay, actually, you'll likely be better off for your retirement if you add two more years to employment, et cetera, et cetera. What are you going to do during retirement if you retire at 60? You know, so some of those kind of behavioral aspects we have to look at, you know, with all of a sudden this new free time on your hands. And so that's part of it. And then lastly is, again, just what type of retirement are they expecting? What's their standard of living going to look like? You know, do they plan on having quite a lot of travel? Do they have, how many kids do they have? Are they going to have to finance some weddings? You know, those types of things. So yeah, we try to use some financial planning software. I like using Excel as well.
With clients who show up who might be getting that late start, do you find most of them do show up carrying mortgage debt?
Yes. Sometimes they've started to take some disciplined approaches to downsizing or be looking at their cash flow and saying, okay, we've got some discretionary expenses that we can start to shave down on. But yeah, there's some mortgages out there. I know we've actually looked at consolidating some, because there's some consumer credit that's come into in those circumstances as well. So yeah, looking at, you know, should we, you know, that conversation, do we pay down our debts or do we look at increasing our savings? Ultimately looking at what is going to have the biggest impact, especially if you've got 20% interest rates on your credit cards. Well, chances are we're not going to find a 20% annual rate of return for you. So we might be better off to pay down your debts. It's obviously part of the conversation and looking at what's the best approach. But, you know, in those circumstances, we'd have to look at, you know, what are their total liabilities versus what are their total savings and what's the best approach.
And you talked about debt consolidation when there is consumer debt on the table. Yeah. Have you had success with debt consolidation in those cases?
Yeah, there's been one particular case where we looked at kind of like a five-year projection as to they were to just aggressively pay down their consumer debt and maintain their current mortgage schedule. Ultimately, what we determined was that they would be better to consolidate and the savings would be somewhere in the neighborhood of about $11,000 or $12,000 over that five-year time frame. So again, that was very impactful from a planning strategy to have like a hard number. Again, that's living in a vacuum, right? That's assuming that there's no additional consumer purchases or debt to accumulate, but at least it gives them a visual to say that, hey, this is something that's going to save you what I would argue is a significant amount of money.
And can I ask how far into that debt consolidation they are?
They will be refinancing this August, so here shortly, and it'll basically eliminate something in the neighborhood of $67,000, $70,000 worth of consumer debt. And like I said, the savings will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $11,000, $12,000 over 5 years.
How long have you been working with those clients before? So this, when you say they're refinancing this August, that'll be the first crack at it. They're just going to start. And how long have you been working with them to this point?
Probably the course of about 4 months, 3 months, you know, having the initial consultation, them saying kind of what their objectives, you know, what's their priority, and then going to do the work in terms of creating some projections and then coming back to them saying, hey, this is a solution that I think would work. And they had, you know, the question is, what should we do, this or that? I looked at both scenarios and said, this one is going to provide you with a better outcome.
Do you have concerns here that obviously their financial habits haven't been ideal to build up that degree of consumer debt? Do you have concerns that they consolidate and then
continue
building up consumer debt elsewhere?
It's a concern. It's been discussed. And that's where I've said to them in the projections that I've presented, this is, again, living in a vacuum. This is assuming that, you know, this problem doesn't repeat itself and they're aware of it. And we'll have periodic reviews to make sure that that's not getting away from them. It's not getting out of hand. And that we're in a situation where suddenly that those high interest rates are, again, kind of depleting their ability to save ongoing.
You've had a fair number of these clients who may be in sort of that late start situation, Craig?
Yeah, a handful.
And do you know why it is that they end up in front of you? Is it that they end up via a referral, or is it that just happens to be fairly common amongst the demographic you deal with?
There's, I guess, a variety, you know, through just Google searches, through referrals, through local advertising, these types of things. So it's been kind of from all angles. There hasn't been one source that dominates, I guess.
I would be remiss if I didn't talk about this. You're in St. Albert, which I think is a little bit of a keeping up with the Joneses kind of problem in St. Albert. You think I'm being unfair there, Craig?
It's a great community. And I can't say specifically where I know of, you know, somebody has to get another a luxury item or something to that effect simply because their neighbor has. You know, I think it's like any community. You've got a wide variety of people with a wide variety of different circumstances. It is a nice community, but I don't think that's a huge issue that's affecting people's ability to plan. I'd probably argue more that it's the minor hockey or something to that effect. That it's a hotbed for minor hockey, and a lot of families put a lot of their resources into their kids' future development in hockey. And I see more money being directed towards different programs for, sport development than their own retirement savings, which is sometimes a very difficult conversation. No parent wants to stymie their child's development, but at the same time, the statistics don't lie. There's a very few number of people who go on to have that professional career. Anyway, that's something I think was more relevant than the keeping up with the Joneses.
It's interesting. And just so people don't think Craig is bad-mouthing hockey, you're a competitive hockey player yourself, Craig, right?
Yeah, I had fun along the way.
Is there any other factors that you see that influence that late retirement? Anything that people can be doing maybe to improve their situation when they do have that late start, or when it maybe feels like there's a late start?
I stress this, I think, fairly regularly in those meetings, is the greatest way to get ahead is to get started. And I think that's sometimes it's a frustrating circumstance for people. And it's about just initiating the process, right? And putting something in place that's disciplined and systematic so that they start the process, because that's the reality. The quicker they get started, the further they'll be ahead.
Do you think that it's more that people feel like they're getting a late start, or do you think that it actually is a late start? Is their feeling true, or is it that they really just are starting when it's appropriate?
No, that's a very good point. I think a lot of the time it's more of a feeling than the reality. I think people have a feeling as to where they should be. But once you start walking through, okay, this is where you're at today, these are the things that we can put into practice now, it gives them a greater sense of where they're at than prior to the meeting, right? By, again, kind of creating that visual as to the trajectory that they're on. Because I think people just have this tendency to think that they're not as far along as they should be, when the reality is they are in a fairly respectable state, and it's just where can we go to improve upon it.
Do you have any idea what it is that gives people that feeling like they might be behind? Are they comparing themselves to something they've read in the media? Or is it the water cooler conversation that there's the one person in the office who's particularly financially savvy who might be kind of the point of reference?
No, I think just with, just the cost of living and some of the uncertainty that's out there right now, just in regards to our economy, people just want to have some sort of comfort as to the direction they're taking. Some of the people that we sit down with, might have suffered a layoff or something like that, and they've had to deplete savings over the last 18 months to 24 months. And that's what's driving these real concerns is, they had a plan in place, or they had a cushion, I guess, of security, and then that security has been removed, right? So they're trying to say, how can I get back to where I was? And I think that's probably more common factor in these situations.
Again, that speaks to the value of holistic financial planning, which, if done properly, should, let's say, reinforce that cushion. Do you have any last minute thoughts, Craig, on dealing with that couple who feels like they might be getting a late start on their retirement planning?
I guess, like I said, just to kind of reiterate what I was saying earlier, is that there's always time, but the best way to get ahead is to get started. Having that conversation, calmly with one another, if it is a relationship, and starting to look at, putting a plan in place, putting practices in place that are systematic, they become routine, they become habitual, and they just become the new normal.
Perfect. Well, thanks very much for sharing those experiences with us, Craig. I know that's a common scenario for financial planners to run into, and I think it's good to talk through some of the thought processes clients are going through and to think about some solutions to that problem. Thanks very much, Craig. Have a great day.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Last interview, we're going to hear from Mitchell, and Mitchell talks again about some retirement planning stuff. Mitchell is fresh out of the CFP program, and you'll hear that in his discussions. He even talks about some of the stuff we talk about in class, and really alludes to his time spent in class learning certain concepts.
let's hear from Mitchell and hear what a relatively young financial advisor has to say about retirement planning and how he deals with clients in this regard.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us today, Mitchell.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mitchell is a financial advisor based in Kingsville, Ontario. Mitchell has recently completed, congratulations, his level one certification with the Financial Planning Standards Council, and on your way, hopefully, to the Certified Financial Planner as well.
Yes.
And also you are licensed for life insurance and accident and sickness and property and casualty insurance, as well as investment funds. I have that right, Mitchell?
Yeah, that's all correct.
Perfect. Mitchell's firm is financial planning focused, so a lot of the work you do will be financial planning work, Mitchell, that's right?
That's very correct, yeah.
Perfect. So Mitchell is a fairly young advisor, I think you said in your early 20s?
Yes.
I'm always interested to hear about younger advisors having retirement planning conversations. One of the traditional knocks you hear or concerns you hear is young advisors who are unable to get older clients to respond to them when it comes time to talk about retirement income or retirement planning. And I know you've had some clients recently that were older than yourself and where you might have encountered that problem. Can you talk a little bit about that, Mitchell?
Yeah, absolutely. So the beauty of my firm in particular is a lot of clients I find end up coming into my office looking for home and auto insurance or potentially looking for life insurance or disability or what have you. And most people, when they sit down with me, they don't realize that I'm going to be talking investments. And I find, especially with older clients, in the ranges of, you know, kind of that 40 plus range, and especially clients who are already retired and looking at income strategies, the second I kind of start speaking to my investment knowledge, I get the nose turned up at me a little bit and the furrowed eyebrows, because I don't necessarily have the resume or the track record that a lot of clients end up asking for. So I find the biggest kind of hurdle on that side of things is trying to prove in that meeting that I'm going to care more about their finances than anybody who doesn't have their last name. And I think that's a huge hurdle, because a lot of these older advisors who have been in the game for a long time, they do have that kind of track record and that resume that they can kind of just throw out on the table. And there becomes kind of this like blind professional trust. And not to bash older advisors, obviously, there's a lot of people who are doing well by their clients. But one particular example is I had some clients in my office, and this must have only been a few days ago at this point, maybe a week or so, and we're still working through the paperwork. But it had kind of been the typical approach where, you know, they had come in to chat about their home and auto insurance moving into town. And I flipped the conversation to ask, well, with moving into a new town, have you, you know, found a new advisor to deal with kind of your retirement strategies? And they were very resistant at first to conversate with me. But as I kind of broke down the barriers, and I found that what I typically would have to do in that kind of situation, it's a little sad to an extent, but you know, you have to flex your muscles a little bit, and you know, fire out a little bit of knowledge and jargon that's, you know, quickly explained afterwards, but at least to show that I know what I'm talking about with, you know, quick confidence, because I need to, you know, prove that, you know, I know what I'm talking about first of all, but also that I care. So I found with these particular clients, the biggest concern they had had, it seemed that the conversation with their particular advisor kept coming down again to the rates that they were receiving on their small portfolio. They were in retirement, living primarily off of government benefits with no workplace pension, with very small amounts in the realms of registered investments for their income, and were already riffing their income. And based off of kind of the projections that their advisor had been giving them with higher, you know, rate assumptions, the plan seemed sound, but I had convinced them to kind of give me an opportunity to at least give them a second opinion. And they were hesitant at first, but after, you know, some conversation and I guess a little bit of a boyish charm, if you would, I convinced them to let me give them a second opinion, and found that based off of a more realistic projection, they were actually going to be out of, you know, personal assets other than their house that they could potentially loan again by the age of 83. And these particular clients, both of their parents were still alive, and they were in their early 60s, and their parents were in their late 90s. So there was clearly no hereditary issues. They had had no health concerns. They had retired healthy, no medical concerns whatsoever, and a clear longevity risk in their house where, you know, running out of money at 83 would be financially and emotionally devastating for them. And it most likely would be, it was pretty much a secure and earlier death on a financial stress side of things. A lot of their concerns seem to be along longevity and security of their assets, but I found that their investment strategy perhaps was not the most sound. And we ended up actually taking a permanent life straight annuity approach with these clients and found that if they were able to just cut a tiny bit of their spending right now in the earlier years of their retirement with an indexed annuity, they were actually going to be sound to have money coming into their account well beyond what they needed on their for their lifestyle expectations well into their late 90s and even into their hundreds if they were so fortunate, or I guess unfortunate depending on who you're asked, to make it that far. So I think again, the biggest hurdle, especially with older clients, is finding the way to not boast my company's returns and not boast to be more than what I am, but just to show that even at a young age, my primary dedication is to my own education and to my clients, so that I would always be, taking the extra time to do exactly what they would require for their best interest and not just what would line my pocket. So we were able to land the account, which was fantastic for the firm, obviously, but I think it'll be a little bit more fantastic for these clients in the long term as well, because I find with this annuity plan now in place, they're going to be far more likely to not run out of their money, which is really their biggest concern.
You know, I'm a big fan of annuities, especially where there's a predisposition to longevity. You talked about flexing your, let's say, financial planning muscles a little bit here without maybe going into too much specifics, but can you paraphrase a little bit of what that looked like? I'm sure there'll be some folks out there that are curious to know, since it obviously was successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And funny you mentioned that with the annuities. I can always hear your voice in the back of my head going, I feel like annuities are undersold. So it always reminds me to take a look at that aspect. So on the flexing your muscles, I find a lot of it is just, even more under your breath. I'll start to recite back, well, you have the, so you'll have the age credit available to you. You have the pension credit. You're splitting the CPP. Start to kind of, think out loud about some of what's going on in my head. I also like to back reference to things like the Financial Planning Standards Council's assumptions guide. So I find having things like that memorized is very helpful, where when they are giving me kind of their asset allocation of their current portfolio and telling me how it's returned, I'm able to just recite back, according to the Financial Planning Standards Council, your mortality rate would be about this age, and you based on your asset allocation and doing some kind of quick off the cuff math, kind of giving that math. It's also very helpful to know rough ideas of tax rates, more average tax rates of what to be expected, and be able to kind of recite those things back. Occasionally, I find if I need to flex a little bit more, I'll throw more jargon into my conversation and make it a touch less understandable, which is, I realize, not ideal, but I'll always double back on that and explain as if I caught myself in the jargon, and explain and educate in the process too. Because I find a lot of what I end up doing in an average meeting is actually educating, because even, your 65-year-old client who's been in the markets for their whole life or have participated in work pensions, still don't know the difference between a stock and a bond, or where MER fees are going and things like that when clients are complaining about fees. So more than anything, even if I... even if I'm not actively, trying to say switch to me, a lot of what I do is just educating on what they have as well, right? Where if they complain about, I've got a 2% fee, just explaining, well, you're with this company, they need to pay compliance, accountants, they need to have a trust, and yada, yada, and just kind of fire through where those MERs go. So to show that I'm not necessarily looking to diminish another company or build mine above it, because I mean, realistically, a company's only as good as their plan. Every company's got pretty well the same, with differences, but every company's got their ups and downs. It really comes down to the plan and not, directly attacking their current plan, but perhaps pointing out some pitfalls. I know in another example, and this might be, this is a touch off of the other one, but another client I had come in, all their financial advisor, their accountant, and their lawyer had all signed off on, and this is going to sound a little ridiculous that all three of them had signed off on it, but they had a cottage up north, and the husband had his address and all of his vehicles listed at the cottage, where the wife had hers all listed at the primary home. And this cottage was purchased recently, so this wouldn't be a valid strategy anymore. And their hope was to have the full lifetime capital gains exemption, or the principal residence exemption, mind you, available on both properties. And in moments like that, I bring in more of a modesty where, you know, I kind of vouch that I'm 98% sure that that's incorrect, but let me speak with my accountant and my lawyer, and end up with kind of an email that I can send over from, you know, second opinions of other professionals as well, to tie into this one big second opinion. It's a lot of times bringing in kind of a third party who also has a resume and a little bit more of a track record above mine, I suppose.
It's a good example, Mitchell. I like that ability to bring that technical to bear, and a good bit of self-awareness too, where you say, you know, I thought about, or I throw in some technical language knowing that I'm going to sort of back off on that technical language. I think you always have to be careful introducing that technical language, but having a conscious thought around why and how you're doing that is helpful there. Going back to your retiring clients or retired clients, the folks that recently moved into the same town you're in, when you looked at annuity quotes here, you said life straight annuity. And I'm curious to know a little bit more about this. Is it two annuities, one each? Is it joint annuity? Are you doing a survivor's benefit on this thing? How did you manage, let's say, longevity risk and mortality risk, maybe a little bit of inflation risk there too?
Yeah, so I had ran quite a few options. And what we ended up rolling with is we ended up taking out an annuity that was going to be split at the source, indexed at 2% to keep in line with projected inflation numbers, with a full survivor's benefit. I had dabbled with the concept of taking out just a 75% survivor's benefit and increasing the income, but realistically, based off of their current lifestyle, throwing more income into the mix than what they had already become accustomed to, which would have been the case if we had done the 75% survivor benefit compared to the 100%, it would have been a little bit more than they were taking right now, and a little bit more than they were currently accustomed to. I felt that the risk in that case was on more of a behavioral basis, where the spending habits and that lifestyle creep would start to kind of creep up on them, where they had become accustomed with living a more kind of comfortable, but, you know, more modest retirement, and bringing in much more income and then, you know, having the potentially the financial decision maker pass away could leave the other one with a much lower benefit and a much lower knowledge of kind of budgeting and things of the sort. So we ended up going with a 100% survivor's benefit, fully indexed to what we expect inflation to be. And it's coming specifically from each of their RIFs.
Right, makes sense. And what about then liquidity risk? So did you retain some liquid assets here? What happens in case of a liquidity emergency at some point?
Yeah, so they specifically had an extra lump sum available that we weren't touching, that was out of their house sale and purchase. They had an additional $30,000 that was sitting. So the long-term strategy, they weren't necessarily looking for long-term growth or returns. They were looking primarily for prevention of capital and liquidity, like you said, on that particular aspect, to cover emergencies that may come up and future potential funeral needs. But the only reason we didn't look at the life insurance as an option there is the liquidity aspect, because it would take several years to really build up a cash surrender value worth, you know, noting as far as that's concerned. So we were opting to leave that $30,000 in a cash equivalent account that would be easily accessed. So we're leaving it just in a high interest savings account, not worrying about returns and considering that 2% inflation that would be eating away at that $30,000, really more of a cost of insurance for that emergency fund.
Perfect. That sounds like a very well thought through retirement plan, which I'm sure helped you to lock in that client to give them the comfort that they were able to deal with you. Do you have any last minute thoughts about dealing with these in retirement clients, whether it's this specific group or just in general as a younger advisor?
Yeah, 100%. Beyond what I'd already touched on, I think the biggest thing is, you know, moving the computer aside, move everything aside, and just have one piece of paper and a pen. and be the person in that room who's absolutely the most interested and the most and cares the most about that client. The other thing that I always make sure as well is I never make a single recommendation or even point to what my recommendations might be in a first meeting. I make it very clear that in my first meeting, my sole job is to get a better understanding of their finances than anybody in the world without their last name, like I said. So it's just sitting there listening, take that home, say goodbye to the clients, cordial as possible, of course, and really sleep on that and really care and not just turn to the quickest sale or the quickest kind of aspect. A lot of the times I like to kind of build a plan and quite literally sleep on it. Funny enough, I actually keep a notepad right next to my bed because I find a lot of times in the middle of the night, I kind of pop up for a glass of water and realize I should do something different. So it's quite literally sleeping on that plan, taking the time to really think it out and coming back with a solid recommendation that addresses every single one of the concerns they voiced, because even in the first 10 minutes of that meeting, they voiced what their concerns were. But by the end of, you know, the 60 minutes that we had sat down and really discussed, their true concerns and objectives had become more apparent and were vastly different than the first things they had said to me by the end of that meeting. So yeah, so it's just, you know, flex the muscles if you need to, of course, especially if you've got a baby face like me. If you don't grow a beard, that's crucial. I can't do that, so I don't have that aspect available to me. But otherwise, yeah, just sit, make it very clear that you care. You know, especially if they're a much older client, treat them like your family to you, like you would give advice to your family, and sleep on your advice before you ever open your mouth, because a lot of the times opening your mouth in that first meeting is what's going to shoot you in the foot, because they're going to go back to their advisor and say, you know, this person said this, and based on that other advisor's knowledge of the plan, it may be easily shut down. So I very much vouch for never once making a recommendation in the first meeting.